Hello. I was going to talk about happiness tonight. What were your states of mind? What states of mind were you running? And if you've been practicing mindfulness, you should be able to tell me this. On Monday, the 22nd of January this year. According to a newspaper article that we received here, there is a scientific formulation which concludes that Monday the 22nd of January is officially the most miserable day of the year. Apparently tattered New Year's resolutions, the faded buzz of Christmas, debt, a lack of motivation and the winter weather all conspire to create a peak of misery and gloom. The saving grace for this particular article is that it also states that scientists also claim to have found the happiest man in the world, and he's a Buddhist monk. Apparently he has astonishing levels of mind control and upbeat brain impulses. Scans show huge levels of activity in the brain's left prefrontal cortex, which is associated with happiness. The right-hand side, which handles negative emotions, is suppressed. The mind is malleable, said the monk. Our life can be greatly transformed by even a minimal change in how we manage our thoughts and perceive and interpret the world. Happiness is a skill. It requires time and effort. I think in that article, it really sums up probably the reason why we're here. Worldly happiness is, unmistakably, it's there. You can find happiness in the world. No one's denying that. But it never ever seems quite enough. And presumably we all come along here because Buddhism, in one form or another, promises us greater happiness. But, as the monk said, it does require time and effort. Aristotle said that happiness, in his opinion, happiness is the meaning and the purpose of life, the whole aim and end of human existence. I wonder if we were to look carefully at the way we behave, the actions we perform mentally, verbally, and through the body, why we perform those actions. If we look closely at them, all of them, at the end of the day, is about gaining happiness. It's about the pursuit of happiness, wanting to be happy. Seems to be common to all people, all beings. And yet so often, the ways we choose seem to come up short. Often they don't come up short by very much, but there seems to be an integral flaw somewhere in this pursuit of what we call worldly happiness. Now this pursuit of worldly happiness tends to be about manipulating the world to make it like we want it to be. And sometimes we can do it very successfully. Healthy body, healthy mind. A clean, tidy environment. Happy family relationships, kids. Success with money. Managing it successfully. Having plenty of interests, friends. Filling our days with all sorts of activities. Abd al-Rahman III of Spain, and this is going back some time, 960 in the Christian era, said this: I have now reigned about 50 years in victory or peace, beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies. Riches and honours, power and pleasure have waited on my call, nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. In this situation, I have diligently numbered the days of pure and genuine happiness which have fallen to my lot. They amount to 14. Reliance on and pursuit of worldly happiness on its own is flawed. And it's flawed for some very simple reasons. It never lasts. It can't be controlled. It's unsatisfactory. The Buddha never denied that it was there, it could be found. Wherever happiness is found, and in whatever way, the Tathagata describes that as included in happiness. Is there another way? Is there another way of obtaining happiness other than through worldly pursuits? Is there a way we can crack the happiness code? Is there another kind of happiness that we can enjoy other than transient pleasures, ambition, and the like? The Buddhist monk certainly seems to have found something. The Buddha's teaching is geared entirely to this one end, how to bring happiness to people, or more precisely, how people can learn to be happy. It has no other purpose. At the end of the very end of the path, when enlightenment comes, you find the highest happiness. The entire teaching is founded upon how beings can find true, pure, genuine happiness. Now, the teaching is based in understanding how the world works and developing our own mind, rather than trying to manipulate externals. So it's an inward-looking rather than an outward-looking teaching on two levels, the mundane level and the supramundane level. The mundane level, we're looking at aspects of the teaching like the 5 points of mundane right view. Actions have results. There's a result to the person who gives. Mother and father are worthy of our respect for bringing us into the world. There are other realms of existence, and there are teachers who can tell us about these things. The 5 precepts, also mundane wisdom. The 10 perfections, generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving-kindness, and equanimity. The 4 divine abidings, loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. On a supramundane level, we're looking at things like the 4 noble truths, condition-dependent origination, the undeniable fact of 3 characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. The whole teaching is, as the monk suggested, is about how we manage our thoughts and perceive and interpret the world. Happiness comes from interpreting it, perceiving it in the right way. It comes from managing our minds in the right way. Now, to understand a little bit about how mundane wisdom brings happiness, I've got another quote here. I don't want to burden you with quotes, but I found so many good ones. A gentleman, an American, called Peyton Conway March said this, and this is on the mundane level. There is a wonderful mystical law of nature that the 3 things we crave most in life, happiness, freedom, and peace of mind, are always attained by giving them to somebody else. It's a paradox. It's one of the beautiful paradoxes of true wisdom. The secret of cracking the happiness code is letting go of the pursuit of one's own happiness and making much of bringing freedom, happiness, and peace of mind to others. So, for instance, the 5 precepts is a very clear and obvious case. By avoiding harming and killing living beings, we bring them peace of mind. We bring them happiness. Same with all the other precepts. Stealing. What was the case somebody told us about recently of a container ship landing on a beach? And everyone going, thousands of people going down there and helping themselves to all the goodies. Isn't that called looting? But if you ask them, they would probably say, well, it's not stealing because, you know, the companies will get the money back on the insurance. And then, of course, we all wonder why the insurance policies go through the roof. Now, if you restrain doing that, then you bring happiness and peace of mind to people, other people. So it's clear then that the whole teaching is geared towards other people. It's how we, it's our relationship with other people that's all important, other beings, other things. It's how we relate to life. If you like, you can say life is relationship. And at the mundane level, it's how to be happy in the world through helping others, through being of assistance to others. So we make much of here, we make much of the parami, for instance. But there's a deeper level too, which I wanted to look at. It's about how our perceptions work. Just imagine for a moment that you've moved into a new house. And you thought it was going to be lovely and peaceful. And then a little while later you start hearing noises from next door, rowdiness, late night parties and the like. And at some point you realise that you have neighbours, what they call it, neighbours from hell. And you have no end of trouble with these people. It might not just be that, of course. There's 101 different ways that we perceive the world. What happens in those kinds of situations is that we project certain images onto other beings. And those projections are reflected back to us. So we have a perception, we create a label that we have neighbours from hell. And the label sticks. And from that point on, the next door neighbours are neighbours from hell. That's how we see them. We forget that actually that was a label that we applied and assume that that's the way it really is. That's very interesting because what happens is we then begin to interpret our neighbour's behaviour based on the label that we've ascribed to them. This is what the monk's saying about learning about how we perceive and interpret the world. We assume that the way we label is correct. And interpretation is very selective. The mind works in a way that it will find the bits that reinforce the perception. So an occasion when perhaps the neighbours are rowdy will be yet more conclusive proof of what terrible neighbours we have. Making these interpretations and projections, reinforcing these perceptions, we make comparisons based on them. We have a perceived problem, and we have a preferred solution or a preferred situation. We create a comparison between what we have and what we'd like to have, forgetting, of course, that what we have is based on our perceptions. What happens then, of course, is that we cannot accept life as it is. And we start manipulating. It's a natural outcome. If it's not how you want it to be, we're going to make it how we want it to be. And so we start manipulating, dominating. We try to control. We try to get people and things to conform to what we think life ought to be, or how life ought to be. Now this gets even more tricky, because in our attempts to dominate, we create expectations about how other people ought to be behaving. We begin to cling to expectations about others' behaviour. Now, clinging in that way is slavery. To cling to an expectation about a way somebody else should behave is slavery for us, and it's slavery for them. It's the opposite of giving them happiness, freedom, and peace of mind. We actually cling. In our clinging, we become slaves, not realizing that it's all arisen because of our own labeling, the way we've chosen to label. And of course, the outcome is there's no happiness for anyone. The way around the problem is to reverse the process. The first thing to do is that you have to give the other person their freedom back. So you have to let go. In any situation, it might not be difficult neighbours, it might be difficult kids. Or it might be that there's somebody with whom you want to have a relationship and they don't want to have a relationship with you. But there's the expectation there. So the very first thing that anyone has to do if they want to reverse the process is to give that person their freedom, which is to let go of the expectation. What about a mother who expects gratitude from her children for all that she does? What if that gratitude isn't coming? If she lets go of the expectation, then there isn't a problem. I know it's difficult, but it has to be pointed out that this is the way to happiness. It's like we live in a hall of mirrors. We project, and what we get back is simply a reflection of what we project. And people will behave either in accordance with those projections or not. But we don't actually have any control over that. So the outcome is, if you let go of the expectations about other people's behaviour and you give them that freedom, as a consequence, they will be that much more happy and peaceful because they're not being pressed upon. Have you ever had a situation where you've been in the company of somebody and you felt a really tight band of pressure on the head? Sometimes you can actually feel sick as well. And it's because that person's trying to dominate you mentally. Anyway. So what you have to do is you have to give people their happiness, freedom, and peace of mind. One of the keys to this is the ability to see difficult relationships and maybe duties that you have to perform, like perhaps looking after an elderly relative, something like that, is to be able to change the perception from seeing it as a difficulty to see it as an opportunity. An opportunity to develop skills in happiness by letting go, by ceasing to attempt to dominate that person or that situation, by ceasing to try and manipulate it, control it. Now, somebody said to me recently that they had a particular situation arising where they felt that the person that they were with and were friends with were conditioning negative thinking for them. And they were wondering whether they ought to continue the friendship. Well, if you have a situation like that and you feel that you have to dominate, you have to try and sort of control the situation so that you won't experience those negative thoughts or feelings. Instead, a far better way is to protect oneself with mindfulness and loving kindness. With mindfulness established, you know exactly what states of mind are present. And if you've been practicing Vipassana, you also know that whatever arises has the nature to cease. You don't have to manipulate them, and you don't have to manipulate yourself All you have to do is just let the situation take care of itself. Whatever arises has the nature to cease. There isn't actually anything that you have to do there. And with loving kindness, you actually change the perception that you have a problem friend. You don't have a problem friend. You have a very complex, emotionally complex individual with whom you're speaking. If you look for their good points, you'll find them. All humans have vastly more good points than bad points. Or, if you like, you can bring in mundane right view that there's more than one life. And you can conclude that this person is here because of the way that they've behaved previously, karma. They've been through all sorts of experiences, both before this life and in this life, which has conditioned them in a certain way. They couldn't be different than they are. And yes, they have got negativity, but don't we all? And if we can see that other beings are pretty much like us, really, dark states, bright states, everyone's made up of good and bad, a sense of compassion can actually arise from that. A genuine sense, if you reflect seriously, that we're all subject to suffering and we're all in our different ways trying to find happiness. Again, in these ways, you just let go of the problem. You let go of the perception that there's a problem person that you're with. Look at their good qualities, recognize their suffering. Takes time and effort. I'm not saying you can just do it like that. It takes time and effort. But you can change your relationship with your world in that way. To do all this is to be of service to others. Now, I'd say in my 5 years here, I've found that being of service to others is a far, far sweeter kind of happiness than the old ways I tried to find happiness. It is far superior in every way. It's like you grow a foot taller, literally. You mature tremendously. Your spiritual faculties become mature through serving others. Yeah, the happiness from giving up selfish pursuit of happiness and instead helping to make others happy really is a superior kind of happiness. But it doesn't end there with the Buddha's teaching. There's this supramundane happiness to be found as well. And in fact, you can go back to the Spanish king's quote. I mean, he must have got his life going pretty well to have those resultants coming up, and yet it still wasn't enough. In the end, what we need to do is let go of the pursuit of happiness entirely. Not an easy thing to do. But vipassana meditation is undertaken for the sake of understanding, not happiness. I know that might come as a bit of a surprise because the Buddha's teaching is all about happiness. But happiness is a welcome byproduct of practicing vipassana. It's a mistake that quite a few meditators fall into, in believing that I sit down to practice vipassana in order to be happy, or synonym to be calm, tranquil, to have nice things happen to me. And this is actually not the case. We practice vipassana for understanding. We want to understand how our world works at the most intimate level. Now, when you get it right, happiness arises as a byproduct, undoubtedly. But what happens if you pursue happiness in the meditation is that you may very well begin with, say, looking at transience, and you observe transience very, very closely, very minutely, and you see that indeed things are transient. And you get very calm. And you get very happy. And you get very blissful. And you think, well, I'm just going to stay here. And you know that the Buddha's teaching is all about how to find happiness. So you conclude, well, I must be doing it right. It's a problem that a lot of meditators fall into. So as soon as you get into that calm state, you know you suppress everything else that you should be looking at. And the inevitable outcome is that the meditation never moves anywhere. So what you have to do, you have to stop pursuing personal happiness. And instead, look at the suffering which actually drives the pursuit of happiness. We need to see the processes that actually bring about the drive for happiness. If you think about it, when you're in meditation and you find it boring, and the next thing you know, you're in a dream world, you're dreaming. There was a point at which you decided you no longer wanted to look at what was happening in your experience. And we decided that we wanted to look at something else, something more interesting. We decided that we wanted to pursue happiness rather than look at what was happening in our experience. There must have been a comparison that must have been drawn. What's happening now is not acceptable. It must be changed for something else. And that's true of all the hindrances. It's a way of getting out of a problem. But with Vipassana, you have to look at the problem. You have to see the processes at work. Consider, I once knew a woman who said that she was very depressed. She labeled herself, perceived herself as a depressed person. One night I was around her house and we were talking, and we decided to watch some telly, and there was a stand-up comedian who was very, very funny. This depressed woman couldn't stop laughing. She had tears rolling down her face with genuine laughter. And yet, once the program had finished, the depression returned. Now, she sees herself as a depressed person. But in actual fact, she's no such thing. She saw herself as being depressed all the time. But I certainly saw that she was not depressed on one particular occasion. There were tears of joy rolling down her face. She was very, very happy. Now the problem, of course, is that she had a fixed, solid perception of herself as being a certain way, as being depressed. It's how she labeled herself. But all mental states are subject to conditionality. They all arise and pass away. They're all insubstantial, actually, the more you look at it. Had she actually had the benefit of Vipassana, she would have seen that, yes, there may well have been depression, but that supporting conditions changed, and happiness arose, laughter arose, and at that time there was no depression, hence the importance of mindfulness. If you keep on looking at the three marks in your experience, then you reach a point where you can no longer call yourself a depressed person. A depression that lasts 3 months, say, can reach the point where it lasts three mind moments, where you literally see the tendency towards depression arise and pass away, if your mindfulness is strong enough. If you don't identify with it, if you don't say, this is me. So the whole purpose of Vipassana is to look at the suffering and see its true nature. So any situation you find yourself, say, any kind of defilement running, say depression, and you say to yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, and you see clearly that indeed it is a conditioned process, its nature is to rise and pass away, then that defilement, that depression must disappear. It can't stay there. You cannot be wise and depressed at the same time. It's just not possible. You can only experience one thing at a time. So either there's wisdom in the mind or there's depression, but you can't have both. And if your mindfulness is good enough, then you will see that when the wisdom arises, the depression is no longer existent. And so the whole process of vipassana is refining that process so you can get to the point where defilements arise and pass away in mind moments. They barely register, but they've been seen. That's the difference. It's a little bit like, I think Alan's used this example before, it's like you've got muddy water. Yeah, and by process of filtration, you get rid of all the alien substance, and you're left with pure water. Essentially, that is what happens with the mind that goes through the process of vipassana, is that because none of these defiling states are taken seriously anymore, they're not identified with, they don't hang around, the mind is left in its natural state, which is happy. Its natural state is happy. So with time and dedication, the meditator becomes happier and happier because they understand the processes of suffering, how they come into being and how they let go of. Now to do that, you had to let go of the pursuit of happiness. You had to let go of forever trying to get happy and look at what the actual problem is. Do you see the difference? You're working on it, okay. So I was going to do a recap here, but just very briefly, the happiness code, the code that brings happiness, is to let go of the pursuit of happiness. Now there's one final aspect to this, which is unconditional happiness, which is the state of the enlightened mind. When the process is completed, you're left with one tiny little problem that you've gone through the four paths which are open to vipassana meditators, at the end of which you've fully understood, you have what Nigel was talking about earlier, perfect view. You understand exactly how life works, but you're not enlightened. There's one tiny little problem. There's still one little comparison that hasn't been dealt with, and that's the comparison of I'm not enlightened and I want to be. And that is a most difficult problem to try and overcome. And the only way you can overcome it is by letting go of the pursuit of happiness. The only way you can find the highest happiness is to let go of the pursuit of happiness, of enlightenment, completely. Letting go of all choices, all preferences, everything. Let it all go, let the whole world go. Only when you do that is the mind then ready, balanced and happy. I mean, you have to truly let go of the desire for enlightenment. Truly, in a very evil, very gut, you have to let go of it. You have to see that is the problem, that's what's holding you up. And then in that moment, when you've done that, and you're just abiding happily and peacefully in the moment, and suddenly this realization dawns, which is so utterly transcendental to anything you've experienced before, just completely liberates, completely. It's understood then that there's nothing further to find. And you can't, I'm not going to try and put it into words because you just can't. But there is the total understanding when that realization happens that this is indeed the highest happiness. There is nothing further to do. It's known, it's understood on a non-intellectual level. It's a very intuitive thing that you know that, and you know, that's the other thing. And so there's just this wonderful, joyous feeling of having arrived. But in actual fact, knowing that you never left. It's just like coming out of a dream. It's so amazing. And you know there's nowhere to get to, there's no one to be, there's nothing to keep, there's nothing you need to do. It's a happiness that isn't dependent upon anything, any worldly thing at all. And it's simply our natural state. It's effortless. You don't make it. It's just the way life really is. And with every step you take, there is the most exquisite sense of fulfillment. And there's love and compassion and a new sense of service, of wishing to help others. Gone over again. Thank you.